Hello again, I'm Warren Olney. On this last episode of our To The Point podcast, The State of the World, with pandemics, climate change, and nuclear weapons, are things really as bad as they seem? Or are we all just programmed with a cognitive bias in favor of bad news? We'll talk with Nicholas Kristof, who's looking for good news. And as the population ages in California, Steve Lopez is calling his LA Times column The Golden Years. We'll hear about his extensive research into possible options for a happy, even constructive, retirement. First, Nicholas Kristof, a journalist with experience all over the world and a one-time prospective candidate for governor of Oregon. Now back to his New York Times column on human rights, women's rights, health, and global affairs. Nick Kristof, welcome.
Great to be with you, Warren.
You have been writing every year a column saying that, hey, this was the best year in human history. Now you say last year, you couldn't quite say that anymore. Why couldn't you say that anymore? And why do you want to say it in the first place?
So, I mean, COVID, the pandemic definitely sent the world into a loop. It lowered education standards. It initially lifted poverty, global poverty. And so it was definitely a setback. But the reason I want to make the point is that I think that the world is way better off than we tend to think it is. And I think that that is partly because of a cognitive bias on the part of the public toward, you know, toward threats, toward bad news. And I think it's partly a bias in how we in the journalism world cover the news and how nonprofits call attention to problems. You know, there's a crisis and I fly off to cover it and nonprofits are warning about the danger and that's all important and good. But I fear that that becomes paralyzing for our audiences. And there's a misperception that the world is just in a constant mess. And so if you ask people, is global poverty getting worse, staying the same, or getting better, then 90% of Americans say it's getting worse or staying the same. And in fact, you know, the revolution over the last half century has been a stunning decline in global poverty, extraordinary improvements in child mortality. And I don't think that we have adequately conveyed that fact. And I guess I also think that, you know, that doesn't breed complacency, but rather a sense of what we can accomplish if we understand what is possible.
Every so often, somebody tries to do a good news newspaper or broadcast or whatever it is, and never seems to work. They don't get the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle myself with that. I understand this bias and yet, you know, I contribute to it. We, in journalism, we cover planes that crash, not planes that take off. But in the context of aviation, our audience kind of understands that. In the context of global poverty, global health, I don't think that they do. And I think we have to periodically step in and say, hey, you know, by the way, the backdrop is the kids are living better lives with less disease and less poverty than they historically did.
Well, those are very important issues, obviously, global poverty and child mortality. But what about the climate, for example? And what about the existence of nuclear weapons and the other kinds of threats that we're faced with?
And those are all very real. And, you know, climate in particular really has the, you know, there's a possibility we will cook our planet. But I guess I'd make two points. One, that, you know, probably for any given person, the worst thing that can happen is to lose a child. And that used to be incredibly commonplace. Historically, almost half of children died as children around the world. When I was born, it was still about a quarter of children died before the age of five. Now we're down to 4% of children dying by the age of five. So, you know, if you think about what matters most to people, there's been incredible improvement about in that world. And in terms of climate, I think that is still an existential threat to our planet. But 5 or 10 years ago, it was really hard to see a path out, a path forward. And, you know, now if you squint just a little bit, you can see a path out. It involves, you know, solar energy, Production prices coming down astonishingly. We're on track now for solar to overtake coal. There's been a technological revolution, everything from, nuclear weapons are certainly a huge challenge for the world, but we have nuclear fusion, which offers, or may offer, always used to be that it was, what was 30 years away. Now it may actually be on a horizon. We may be making progress. Green hydrogen, all kinds of new technologies that do offer some real hope of charting a path forward.
You do have to squint pretty hard, however, when the coal operators, the oil operators, and others seem to be working against the efforts to do what you suggest, which is to try to provide energy in a clean way.
Yeah, that's right. And there's, there's enormous resistance, and we haven't handled it all that well. There, every country wants everybody else to address it. And there are going to be enormous displacements. I mean, I don't, temperatures are going to rise, but we do have the prospect of making real progress in reducing carbon emissions. Reforestation is going to be a huge challenge, but we'll see. And direct air capture is controversial because it can create an excuse for not doing more on the reduction of carbon emissions. But it, in the long run, some people see that as a way of also remedying past contributions. So we'll have to see, where technology takes us. But I do think that there is hope now in a way that it was really hard to feel very hopeful, even 5 years ago.
You said earlier that one of the reasons you couldn't say that 2022 was one of the best or was the best so far was the pandemic. Is there optimism to be found in the way the pandemic was handled and is being handled around the world?
So the optimistic component of that is that the developing world, where the stakes are the greatest, seems to have been affected, with some exceptions like that of India, less than that of the developed world. And incredibly, child mortality somehow seems to have continued to decline during the pandemic. Poverty did rise in 2020 and 2021, but it seems to have dipped again. The number of people around the world living in poverty seems to have dipped in 2022. So it seems to, have been a setback of maybe 5 years or so rather than 25 years, which was possible. But I think where we, what is really discouraging is that we haven't really learned the lesson of the dangers of pandemics or the dangers of not addressing public health, for example. And we're still very focused on clinical health rather than public health. There had been a lot of warnings about pandemic danger, and it was always focused on not so much on coronaviruses, but on flu, like avian flu. And now, we didn't actually progress on the broader issue that much of pandemic preparedness. And now there are again concerns about the possibility of a deadly avian flu.
And we have politicians that are advocating against the idea of taking precautions during a pandemic. I suppose that's something that might come and go depending on what the health of the public ends up being.
Oh, I mean, that's so discouraging. Right now, Warren, I'm talking to you from rural Oregon, and this is a very conservative area where our family farm is. And, a lot of folks bought into these conspiracy theories about the danger of, claiming that vaccines were dangerous, and a lot of people died as a result.
So obviously that, too, points to the potential for the media, you and me, and the things that we do to try to make things better. And I'm very interested. You said you're in rural Oregon. You're on your family farm. And I want to have you talk a bit, if you will, about your experience of last year, because you left your job at the New York Times to run for governor of Oregon. As it turned out, you were unable to do that, not for any reason that had anything to do with you, but for reasons having to do with the nature of the laws in Oregon. So now you're back at the Times, but did that have something to do with what I've seen you mention in the past columns, and that is the importance of local action as opposed to these broad national and international actions that we've talked about so far.
I think there were a couple of factors. I mean, partly it was that, you know, I was always telling people to get involved in politics and, you know, including run for office. And it kind of felt I should maybe think about walking the walk. I was also just, really kind of upset about the way things were going. My previous book had been about Americans left behind. And at that point, more than a quarter of the kids on my old school bus had died from drugs, alcohol, and suicide, deaths of despair. And now, now it's up to more than a third of the kids on my old school bus. And to see some of these social problems around us, homelessness, educational failure, social isolation, addiction, lack of mental health treatment, that kind of galvanized me. And, the result was something of a belly flop in politics. But I'm glad I tried. I did what I could. It sure didn't work out. But, but I gave it my best. And I learned a lot in the process.
What'd you learn?
It's sort of interesting. I mean, I'm writing a memoir right now. Actually, it'll come out about a year from now. So I've been thinking about this for the memoir purposes. And I had always thought of politics as somewhat dysfunctional, and running for office just completely confirmed that view. degree to which everything was dependent on fundraising. And partly as a result, the way older people had a disproportionate impact on the political process, because, older people are more likely to vote, especially in primaries, but also older people are the ones who donate. The median contribution to a political campaign is by somebody, it's approximately 60 years old. And also, to some extent, it was sort of the grass is greener. I mean, as a writer, I was always periodically frustrated that, there were these problems and there were these evidence-based solutions. And I was frustrated that politicians didn't seem to be more inclined to put them in practice, homelessness, all kinds of addiction. And then running for office, I really saw the constraints on politicians that as a journalist, I'm paid to be provocative. I'm paid to be controversial, to talk back to my base. That's a lot harder to do when you're running for office, especially in a primary.
Back to the question of old people, the population is aging. Young people are saying, I have a grandson who simply doesn't want to have children. He just got married, but they don't want to have children because they're so worried about the fate of the world. Are they going to be willing, do you think, to take care of us, to take care of the older people, as we get to be a bigger proportion of the population, and we'll need to have help from them?
My wife and I are always sort of jokingly telling our kids about the importance of filial piety. And, some of these stories from China about filial piety. So I don't know. I mean, that's an open question. It's going to be a real burden. And it's less of a burden in the U.S. because our total fertility rate has not dropped as much as it has in some other countries. And also because we still do have immigration. I do think that there are Japan is interesting because it suffered a catastrophic decline in fertility and then managed to bring it up a little bit. I think that one of the lessons of the fertility crisis and of the labor force participation is that we have to do a better job on childcare. If you look at women in the labor force, the U.S. used to be a real leader on that. And now, incredibly, Japan has a higher share of women in the labor force than the United States does. And that's because, you know, Japan has actually a pretty good childcare system called the Hoeikuen. When we lived in Japan, we sent our kids to the Hoeikuen. And the U.S. has a catastrophic lack of system for childcare that makes it really difficult in the U.S. to have to have and to raise kids. And it's bad for working parents, and it's also bad for kids who, you know, who don't get the socialization that they need. And, you know, especially when there are problematic parents, then a childcare program can be that missing link that can invest in that child and support that child. In the U.S., we don't do that.
You've traveled the world. You've been to many places, and you continue to travel as part of your job. What about the capitalist system that we have in this country?
So I talk to a lot of young people who think that the fundamental problem now is capitalism.
Yeah.
So I disagree with that as a broad statement, and that's partly because, you know, I'm shaped by the experience from 1945 to roughly 1975. There was this incredible period when capitalism delivered both very rapid economic growth and also a fairer division of the pie. It both expanded the pie and divided the slices more equally, and that underscored that, you know, markets and capitalism really can work. And if you, you know, look at how Asia in particular managed to reduce the number of people living in poverty, you know, markets and capitalism had a lot to do with that. But having said that, you know, it's pretty clear that since 1975, you know, the U.S. has seen inequality rise, has seen lots of people mired in deep poverty. And their communities like mine and that, you know, when I was just in Somalia recently, and when I go to Somalia, I have a vocabulary to describe the poverty there. In poor communities in the U.S., whether it's downtown Baltimore or, you know, some rural part of the country, we don't really have a terminology that can cover not just low incomes, but also lack of good jobs, chronic unemployment among prime-age men, addiction or alcoholism, family breakdown, social isolation, you know, health longevity that is staggering. Mississippi now has a lower male life expectancy than Bangladesh. You know, how can that be? And so I, you know, I think that capitalism has not worked over the last roughly half century for a lot of blue collar folks with limited education. And that's partly because we've screwed up in education. And it's, you know, I think, you know, the collapse of private sector labor unions has been a factor in rising inequality. I think our narratives changed, and we ended up putting a lot more emphasis on the pull yourself up by the bootstraps narrative, and the, you know, narrative that it's all about personal responsibility. And, you know, personal responsibility is real. Some of my friends who struggled would completely acknowledge that. But if we're going to have that conversation about personal responsibility, we also have to have a conversation about collective social responsibility to those who are left behind, especially kids.
You mentioned that extraordinarily productive era between 1945 and 1975. And it's often pointed out that when Eisenhower was president of the United States starting in 1952, the minimum tax for upper income people was 90%. Now it's down to, what is it, 30 some odd. There's been an enormous concentration of wealth at the top and very little effort to spread it out. Is that responsible, do you think, for what's happened?
So I'm not... You know, I'm not an economist, but I think a lot of smart economists argue that while, you know, if there's too little inequality, no incentives, then that can dampen growth. But that when you get too much inequality, then that also dampens growth. And the IMF and World Bank have both made that point. And I think that, you know, in the U.S., we have reached that point. I think the underinvestment in human capital for many Americans is something that holds back the entire country. And there's also a lot of evidence about just what that does to societies, a lot of evidence in social psychology. It turns out that when, you know, passengers, when you board a plane, sometimes you go through first class and sometimes you just immediately, you know, start and go into economy, and that they're much more likely to be air rage incidents if people first walk through the first class and are exposed to, you know, to that inequality. And
I understand that. I walked down those aisles before
you take your middle seat and, you know, right. Row 44. And so, I mean, that's, you know, there are an awful lot of Americans who are stuck in, 44B, and they know what's going on in first class. And meanwhile, they see that, their kids aren't going to be living better lives. When for Americans born in the 1940s, by age 30, 90% were doing better than their parents were at age 30. For those born in 1984, only half are doing better, and, you know, half are not. And so that inflames the sense of resentment. I think it leads people to turn to conspiracy theories. I think it leads people to turn to bigots and to, you know, listen to charlatans who blame scapegoats.
Well, here we are, perhaps sliding back into the cognitive bias toward the bad news, which, as you say, can be paralyzing. We don't want to have that happen. So what gives you hope? What do you think we have to be optimistic about and as we go forward?
So I really do think that so let me say three things. I mean, one, technology. We talked about technology in, in energy and clean energy. I think that's real. Also, healthcare. I think there are some sort of enormous changes in that direction. Again, a second is that I think there is much greater attention to evidence now than there has been. It used to be that somebody would have a gut sense that, okay, this is going to be the best way for kids to learn reading or to address some other social problem. Now, more and more, we actually, you know, understand what will work at what cost. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And finally, education. I just believe that education is maybe the most important way we can change the world. When I was a kid, a majority of human beings had always been illiterate throughout history. Right now, we're up to almost 90% adult literacy. That's a different world. And in elementary schools around the world, girls are now as likely to go to school as boys. That's, again, just an enormous gender change.
More likely to be in college, I think.
And in the U.S., more likely to be in college by a substantial margin. And so, you know, this is a different world. Education does create opportunity. I wish education were more fairly allocated in the U.S., but especially globally, the degree to which more kids have access to education, that gives me hope.
I suppose what you're really saying is that we have to have some confidence in the creativity and overall capacity of the human species.
Yeah, that, you know, nothing is certain, but if we have the capacity to create nuclear weapons that can destroy the globe, we also have the capacity to come up with nuclear fusion that can provide the energy for, you know, all kinds of processes that we can barely imagine. And it's up to us to determine, you know, where we invest, what technologies we invest in, and how we use them. That's on us.
Nick Kristof, it's great to talk with you, and thank you so much for being with us. You've done so many things, and you will do so many more in the future, no doubt. Great to have you today. Thanks a lot.
Great to be with you, Warren.
We'll take a very quick break and come right back with LA Times columnist Steve Lopez on To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, and I'll be back again with To the Point. One of the best reasons for reading the Los Angeles Times is Steve Lopez. His column is now called Golden State. We'll find out why in a minute. Whatever the title, Steve's columns are witty, they're wise. He has a way of getting to the essence of whatever he's writing about. He's won multiple awards in the process. He's also a novelist and the author of nonfiction books, including The Soloist, a bestseller about Nathaniel Ayers, the Juilliard-trained violinist who suffers from schizophrenia. The Soloist was made into a movie with Robert Downey Jr., starring as Steve Lopez. Now, we've got the real thing. Steve, welcome to The Point.
Hey, it's so good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Why are your columns now under the title of Golden State?
Well, because, do you like that double entendre? It's something I had been thinking about for quite a while, which was as I aged and began dealing with, various aging issues, health and otherwise, and as I approached a half century as a journalist that's coming up pretty soon, I thought maybe now's the time for me to focus on something that I think is sort of underreported in our newspaper and in other, at other news outlets, and that is this cresting, this massive global cresting age wave and all of the challenges that will come with it. So I wanted to write a column about the blessings and the burdens of aging, and it seemed like being in California, Golden State, was a good name for it.
You have a lot of personal information in there, including the fact that you just referred to, two fake knees and a pacemaker, and you're losing badly to your wife at tennis.
You know what? I know I wrote that, but boy, it sounds pathetic hearing it back.
Well, it sounds pretty familiar to me. I'm there too.
I've had a heart issue for a while, and another thing is that there are all of these big decisions that you've got to make. I spent time thinking about whether I should retire, and the conflict for me there was, you don't know how much time you have left, and you don't know how many of those years are going to be healthy years, and should I do something other than what I've been doing for the last 50? So these are the things that, in my experience, a lot of people who I might consider peers, some of them the same age, some of them younger, some of them older, were considering, and I heard the conversation so many times, I just thought it'd be good to start focusing on that exclusively in the column.
Well, you wrote a book about it, too, and I want to get to that in a minute. But one of your recent articles was about Zeke Emanuel, who's an oncologist, a bioethicist. He was very prominent in the Obama administration. His brother was as well. I think two of his brothers were. And recently in The Atlantic, he wrote an article about how he's going to refuse any medical procedures after he's 75, even for cancer. He's now 65, as he writes that piece. You talked to him. What did you find out from him, and was it useful?
Well, what he did, Ezekiel Emanuel, who works at the University of Pennsylvania.
Let me just say, I'm corrected. I think the article was from 2014, but go ahead.
Yeah, what he said in the 2014 Atlantic piece, and this is a guy who worked on the Affordable Care Act. He's a thought leader when it comes to medicine. And what he said was, and there's a part of what he's arguing that I tend to agree with, which is that we won't live forever in this country. We you know, we spend a fortune on anti-aging, you know, remedies, with much of it snake oil, and we have trouble accepting death as a natural part of life. And what he wrote was that, you know, maybe the best years are behind you when you hit 75, which is, you know, not necessarily true in many cases. So he got that part wrong, I think. But the other thing is that he said that he would not take any life-extending, you know, remedies or therapies, as you say, like surgery or chemo or radiation. But he took it another step further than that. He said that he's not even going to take vaccines. He won't take antibiotics. He's just kind of done and will let nature take its course at 75. And when I talked to him, he said that nothing has changed in the 8 years since he wrote that piece. What I'd like to know is check back with him as he approaches 75 to see if he still feels the same way. But since I started writing this column, Warren, I'm hearing from people in their 70s, their 80s, their 90s, and past the century mark, who are still doing amazing things. And I think the major fault with Dr. Emanuel's, you know, proposal here, his essay, is that it's an individual situation. And, you know, one doctor wrote to me to say he's got 90-year-old patients with the bodies of 60-year-olds, and vice versa. So you can't put a number out there like 75 and expect that to really mean much, because people are going to decide on their own what works for them.
Back to the context, talk a little bit more, if you will, about what you referred to earlier as the cresting situation, with so many older people, or so many people now becoming older, and the population itself aging.
Yeah, two things are happening right now, globally. Not everywhere, but for the most part, the birth rate is slowing down. And that boomer wave is cresting. So we are rapidly racing toward a time in the next several years where the world will have more people who are older than 65 than younger than 18. And that is it's kind of like we're you know, some have referred to it as the silver tsunami, and some of us are going to be washed out by this. In California, for instance, there's a projected healthcare shortage that is more than 3 million. We're going to need elder care that is, in some cases, in short supply today. And we don't have enough young people coming up to pay into the institutions like Social Security and Medicare that support older adults. And we're not going to have enough people to take care of them. These questions that aging Californians and others are going to have center around, how do I pay my bills and who's going to take care of me?
So Zeke Emanuel's solution, if that's the right word, might become something that you don't have an option about anymore.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think there's going to be legislation on that. And he does say, look, He's not telling anybody to do what he's suggesting that he'll do for himself. He's just trying to make a point and be provocative. And he was quite provocative.
I didn't mean to force him into the wrong slot there. That's not fair. And he's not fair here to defend his column. One of the things you talk about in your column, you mentioned it a moment ago indirectly, is the business of aging. All these pharmaceutical ads and the invitations that we get for our retirement from Social Security and the AARP. There's a lot, you know, it's all over the popular culture in different ways.
Yeah, it's and you know, if you make the mistake of turning on the television late at night, you see all of those drugs that are marketed to us. And there's an interesting thing about that marketing. It's that, I forget the term, it's like direct-to-consumer marketing, whatever the term is for that. But it's like, that's not my doctor who is telling me I should be taking this particular medication. And, you know, there have been many cases in which those drugs were, you know, held out promise for addressing other ailments without much proof at all that they work on those ailments. And You know, you see those things and you think, well, I guess I need Eliquist or I need Jardiance. I don't know where the hell they come up with the names for these things, but you convince yourself that you got to have them. You know, your doctor is not a part of that conversation.
And what I love is that while the pictures are showing older people being utterly happy and having a wonderful time and even enjoying themselves with younger people from time to time, there's this voice that's speaking very rapidly and telling you about all the downsides and the potential problems that you might have, including death, if you use these substances.
Yeah. And, you know, you can't read the small print.
No, you can't.
For my book, I looked into one of them and went way deep into the small print. And it's frightening what can happen when you take a drug that's intended to save your life. I'm not sure that the cost is of saving my life is a fair deal, given all of the potential side effects.
Well, let's talk about that book. Independence Day is the name of it. That's your latest subtitle, What I Learned About Retirement from Some Who've Done It and Some Who Never Will. That's a great title. And I want to talk about David Bowie, and that you have a quote from him at the beginning of the book. As you get older, you become the person you always should have been. Elaborate on that. I like that.
Well, I you know, I think that it's true. I think that you go through so many different phases in your life, trying to figure out what it's all about and who you want to be, what you want to be when you grow up. It's all, you know, like it's all, of course, a learning experience. I feel like as a journalist, I've been in a graduate program for 50 years, learning about different people and different lives and different things. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful education. And I think along the way, you have some radical ideas and some crazy thoughts. And then, I don't know, I'm getting to where I'm kind of settling down a little bit. And I feel comfortable in my own skin. And maybe that's what David Bowie was talking about. I'm feeling pretty comfortable. I'm feeling pretty good about where I've been and about my notion of what to do with the rest of my life, however long that might be or short.
Well, one of the things that the book illustrates, it seems to me, is how devoted you are to your profession. Because as you're seeking to learn more, you went out and did a lot of what you can do all the time, which is to interview a lot of people and talk to them and ask their advice and counsel. And you talked to a lot of interesting people. Tell us about some of the ones that made the biggest impression on you.
Well, there were a lot of people whose counsel meant a lot to me. I will say that I gave myself a year to figure it out. I thought it would be nice if the book had this kind of TikTok element, and I began actually writing it on 4th of July, and decided that by the next 4th of July, I'd decide whether I wanted to retire or not, which is why the book is called Independence Day. And during that year, I wavered. There were times when I was pretty sure I was going to retire, and there were times when I was pretty sure I was absolutely not going to retire. And I'm one of those people who I guess is tremendously influenced by the last person they spoke to. And so I was all over the place on this. I will never forget sitting down with Father Greg Boyle, who of course has run Homeboy Industries for several decades in Los Angeles, helping former gang members coming out of prison, you know, rebuild their lives. And I sat with him, and one reason is that I wanted to talk to him is that Father Greg and I are the same age. And I asked him if he ever thought about retirement, and he said, "Oh, absolutely not. I'm a Jesuit," he said, "and you know, Jesuits retire to the graveyard." And he said, "Are you really thinking about it?" And he thought of me as somebody who really enjoys my job. And what he said to me was, "The key is to go where life is and to do what replenishes you. And there are great rewards in that and in, you know, serving others. And if you've got a chance to do that in the work that you've been doing, why you need to think long and hard about why you would leave that." So that made quite a big impression on me.
Interesting to talk about him, because not only did he help, or has he helped, and will continue to help, no doubt, people rebuild their lives, he's also presided over a lot of funerals.
He certainly has. And, you know, you would think that that part of it might be, after a while, how much more of that can you take? But there's also daily rebirth. I mean, when you hang with Father Greg, you see him celebrating the progress that people are making as they try to reclaim their lives and build families and step away from all of the things that pull them into lives of trauma and tragedy and sadness. So I think that, you know, each day he's kind of reborn.
You talked to some interesting and very creative people in the entertainment business, Mel Brooks and Norman Lear.
Yeah, I wanted to, and the reason is that they're in their 90s and they're still working. And I wondered if, as somebody, you know, I'm not in, I wouldn't say that writing a column is as creative a field as making television shows and movies, but as a columnist, you do stare at a blank page and you got to fill it with something. And what I wondered is, in their cases, if those creative energies were like their form of oxygen. And if you stop doing it, you suffocate. And, you know, Norman Lear was interesting and quite the philosopher. And he said, life is about what's over and what's next. And you're kind of in a hammock suspended between the two. And as long as there's something that gets you out of the hammock, or gets you out of bed, you have a thought, an inspiration, just embrace that. Don't try to think about what happens the day after tomorrow. Just go with that and feel grateful that you've got that tug, you know, and that's not necessarily, you know, earth-shaking advice, but it really resonated with me. And Mel Brooks, on the other hand, ends up becoming something of a life coach for me. He said, "So you really love what you do?" And I said, "I do love it. I feel privileged, especially given the demise of the newspaper industry, that almost 50 years in, I'm still able to go out and meet with people and parachute into their lives and learn something from them. But I'm worried that I'm going to be one of those guys who waits to retire a little too long, and then I don't remember as I'm ready to travel around the world, I'm too hobbled, or I don't remember my wife's name. And that scares me. And I've got some of the same health challenges that my parents had. I seem to be on the same calendar." And he said, "Well, how about this? You really love what you do. So you go to the LA Times editors and you tell them, 'Thank you very much. Love this job. Want to keep doing it, but not so much. I want to cut back a little bit and go hybrid.'" And it just made perfect sense. When I spoke to him, I was getting close to a decision, and that kind of pushed me over the edge. And I did exactly what Mel Brooks suggested, and I asked if I could go to 3/4 time and take a 25% pay cut. And so that's where I am, and I've been doing that a year and a half now. And I might eventually go to working 2/3 of the year, and then maybe half the year. But I like the idea right now of holding on to something that I really love and that I find, as Father Boyle put it, it replenishes me. It's where life is. I get to visit people in their homes and in their places of work, and I always learn something, and I feel pretty lucky.
You talk about health challenges, and you've had them. At one point in the book, you say, "I was dead."
Yeah, and quite... quite literally, I went in for the first of two knee replacements, and in post-op, my arrhythmias turned out to be a little bit you know, more serious than I knew, or than my doctors knew. So I went into cardiac arrest and I flatlined, and I had to be resuscitated. And you know, I left with a not just a new knee, but with a pacemaker. And since then, it's progressed into atrial fibrillation. And it's another thing that's always there in the back of my mind. Having gone to the dark side once, I'm just reminded that, you know, it can happen. It can happen again at any time, even though I'm under the care and management of a good cardiologist. It really was for me a wake up in more ways than one when I came to and realized what had happened. I wanted to be more thoughtful about my time on this planet and what I'm doing with it. And I became, I think, maybe in some ways closer to family, more appreciative of loved ones and of the work that I get to do. It really shakes you up when you wake up and are told by doctors that, hey, you were gone for a while.
That'll get your attention, all right. And I have to say that I share some of that with you. I've never had to go have that experience, but I do have atrial fibrillation, and it's something that you have to be concerned about all the time. Let's go broader. You mentioned that Norman Lear is a philosopher of a kind, and there's no doubt that's true. What about philosophy, and what about the ancient philosophers? They certainly labored to try to understand the idea of the fact that life is short and bound to come to an end.
Well, for sure, and I tell myself, I don't think I fear death. I think I had an email. I've not had a response to any columns in my many decades of work like I've had since I wrote the first Golden State column. I have literally in the thousands of responses from readers, and I'm still plowing through. It seems to have touched a nerve, maybe partly because so many of the people still reading newspapers are my age and older. I got an email from a guy the other day who said that, I don't fear death. I fear suffering. And I've heard from so many people who have reinvented themselves. And you come to grips as you age with the reality of your own mortality. There's one woman who emailed me, and I can't wait to go and sit with her. She said that she has three forms of cancer for which she is receiving, quite debilitating treatment. And while she's experiencing this, she lives somewhere near the water. She said she wakes up and sits on her patio and looks out at the water and then gets to work. And her work is that she is learning three languages while dealing with three cancers. And I've been inspired by the people who, facing tremendous challenges, are just living their lives and grateful for what they're dealing with. I'm working on a column now about a 102-year-old World War II veteran, a cryptologist, who is just about flat broke. And I mentioned him in a column, and readers want to help him out, and I went to see him. And he said, "No, I'm fine." And I said, "But you got a $500 gas bill for a one-bedroom apartment and people want to help." And he said, "I just, there are people in worse shape than I am, and things are pretty good for me." I'm finding that there are a lot of people really struggling and other people just coping and, doing maybe a little bit of what Norman Lear said. You're in that hammock and yesterday is over. And let's get to today and enjoy what we've got left.
I love the chapter you spent with Nancy Schlossberg, a psychologist who has a list of categories of people as they move toward retirement or as they age. Do you have that in mind? I've got it written down here.
She told me that I was in, she's got the six categories.
Yeah.
They are the couch potatoes. That's not exactly her term, but the people who, and she had, in addition to her six categories, which are based on years of study, and she called me, by the way, a continuer. She said, "You may retire, but that doesn't mean you're not going to write. That doesn't mean you're not going to do a freelance piece or maybe work on a book. So is that even retirement?" Then there are the people who completely reinvent themselves and take up, flying airplanes or making rugs or
adventurers, she calls them.
Yeah. And then you've got the people who find gratification in volunteering. You've got the people who spend more time with the grandchildren. I thought that the best advice from her, though, was that retirement is a huge transition, and it will impact your life in ways you maybe have not considered. It will change your relationship with your spouse, with your colleagues who become former colleagues, with the way you engage with the world. And I got a taste of that when I was writing the book and the at the height of the pandemic, and the LA Times offices were closed. So I was working at home more. And I told my wife one day, who's a freelance writer who works at home, hey, this is like a preview of my retirement. We're spending all this time together. And she said, if this is a preview, I don't want to see the movie. And what she meant was, she's got her own routines. I've got my own routines.
Yeah.
We don't live in a huge house. And she didn't want to necessarily bump into me six times a day for the rest of her life. So it was her message to me to, maybe you want to keep working. And if you don't, maybe you want to develop some hobbies and find yourself, you know, a few friends and set up some play dates that don't involve her. So I think that the transition is huge. And Nancy Schlossberg herself had a tough transition going from working as a professor to having idle hours and then losing her husband.
Well, what I loved about her, too, is that she's 91 years old, but she had to break off a telephone conversation with you because her boyfriend was calling.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
I thought it was.
Yeah, I was so impressed by that. Way to go, Nancy.
You talk about, and I have this issue as well, you work to such an extent that you don't have a lot of a social life. That seems to be true more of men than it is of women, according to you, in the work that you've done and the people that you have talked to over time. Talk about that, the difference between men and women in this context.
Well, there's a geriatric doctor at Brown University who put it in plain terms. We men are not as smart as women. And
I believe that's true.
And they are more social beings, and they also tend to be far greater at multitasking than we men do. So they'll have full careers, but also build social networks. And we men are incompetent to do more than, you know, we can chew the gum really well and we can walk really well. We have trouble putting the two together. And I you know, it's not that I don't have really good friends. It's partly that I've moved around a lot and they're scattered around the country. And and the work is demanding. And that's one of my regrets in life, is that I didn't hold on to and nurture friendships that that are going to be needed for sure as I scale back more on work and try to build new social activities.
Well, I find the same thing. And the older you get, the more you realize you really want to be in touch with people and stay in touch with people and whatever happened to so-and-so. And it's not just a matter of idle curiosity. It's something you need to sort of fill up your life.
Yeah, you sure do. I mean, another person I got really good advice from, you asked Warren who made an impression on me. Rabbi Naomi Levy said to me that before I pull the ripcord and jump out of the plane, or vice versa, I guess. she said,
shut the door of the plane and stay inside.
Yes, she said that a lot of people need structure. And she said, you may be somebody who needs structure. So that's one consideration. And she said, the other thing is, people, as they're working, many of them have these notions of what they're going to do to fill those days, all of those new idle hours. And they kind of idealize it. And when they get to it, it's not quite what they thought it would be. And she said, if you can at all work it this way, sample the dream. Take, a 4-week vacation if you've got that much time coming to you. And go and do this thing that you think you're going to want to do in retirement to make sure that it's going to be fulfilling for you. And in my case, I've always wanted to learn languages and to learn more about cooking and to also make my own music. And so I've taken her up on this challenge. And in the year and a half since I finished the book, I've played the guitar nearly every day. And I've gotten a lot better. And it's something that is going to be, it's like having a friend going forward, you know, that it's going to be there for me. And I really look forward to my time each day on the guitar. And her advice to sample the dream was really, really sound advice.
Are you planning to do any performances at local clubs, do you think? Maybe people would like to dance to your guitar playing?
Well, do you sing, Oren?
Do I? Sure.
Well, okay, then. Look, we've got a band. All we need is a couple other people. We've got a band.
I was the lead in Brigadoon when I was in high school.
Well, look, we're set, you know. We,
we've got it made, yeah. All right, well, I'll tune up and try to do the best I can. Let me, one final question. Back to the very beginning when you talked about the cresting of older people in the society in general. Do you think that that is going to help to erase the kinds of stigmas that occur with old age or make them worse?
Well, I think there is, you know, talking about Dr. Emanuel, I was concerned that one of the impacts of him saying, you know, at 75, you've lived your full life, get out of the way, was that he'd be fanning the flames of ageism, which is very real. And I've heard in these thousands of emails I've been getting from a lot of people who wanted to keep doing the work that they were doing, but feel as though they were nudged out. I think we've got a long way to go in addressing ageism and, you know, the changing of the guard and the arrival of younger people with new and fresh ideas is always a healthy thing. But I do fear that we're going to see a lot more ageism in the marketplace and media and beyond. And, you know, it's something that it's one of the things that we've got to that I hope to keep an eye on. And write some columns about with this new column of mine. And Warren, I'm wondering if it's okay for me to ask you a question. We're talking about, you know, retirement. We're talking about having, you know, had long careers. And I'm wondering if I understand correctly, is this possibly the last of your shows for KCRW?
Yes, it is. This is the last podcast of To the Point, and Which Way LA Went Away several years ago. So, yeah, this is it.
Well, I'd like to say a couple of things about that, if I can.
Sure.
First of all, thank you. Thank you so much. I came to I'm not from Los Angeles. I came here. I'm from Northern California, but I moved here 22 years ago from the East Coast, and I didn't know a thing. And listening to your show has been extremely helpful in teaching me about what's important and who the players are and better understanding Los Angeles. And I've got some comments from some people who would like to say something about your contributions. If I could read those, I'll make it quick. Is that okay?
I guess so.
Okay. This is from.
I didn't know about this.
This is from the current mayor of Los Angeles, who, of course, served in the state legislature and also in Congress. Karen Bass says, Warren, what you have accomplished has been an outstanding contribution to civic life in Los Angeles. I thank you and the countless listeners over the years. Thank you for the public service you have done for all of us by ensuring we are educated about what is happening in the world around us. Sheila Kuehl, the recently retired county supervisor, said, Warren Olney has long been one of the best voices on radio from To the Point to Which Way LA. As a sometime guest, I always felt safe, pressed, and intelligently challenged. I love this guy. Fernando Guerra says, at one of the darkest moments in LA history when we collectively wanted to speak, listen, and understand, Warren Olney gave Angelenos the question, so we could begin to struggle with the answer, which way, LA? I'm eternally grateful for a true Angeleno who helped us struggle to build a city we want to live in. At the Center for the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University, I hope to prepare students, inform leaders, and motivate activists to build on the work of Warren Olney. One more. This is from Zev Yaroslavsky, retired from the County Board of Supervisors and other elected positions. Zev says, as a college student, I remember Warren Olney as a journalist extraordinaire. He was the kind of person who exuded objectivity and integrity. In my public service career, I was interviewed by Warren dozens of times. I could always expect the most probing, incisive, and often challenging questions. What drove me nuts about him is that he would see through the BS of a politician's answers to those questions. He would pull back the veneer of talking points, drilling down to the essence of the subject, sometimes making me terribly uncomfortable. He didn't do this to be ornery. He did it for the benefit of his listeners and, more broadly, the good of our democracy. That is why I place Warren Olney in the pantheon of the greatest journalists Los Angeles has ever known. His was a job exceedingly well done. I say to that, Warren, ditto, and thank you so much for your contributions. You're a local institution and a treasure. Okay, this one is from Larry Mantle, longtime host at KPCC across town. Warren, you are not only a gifted host and journalist, but your care for our community shows in every aspect of your work. During your extraordinary career, you've earned the trust of thousands of guests and millions of listeners and viewers. They know that your discussions are focused on helping us better understand each other and on improving the quality of life in our city. Warren, you exemplify the best of broadcast journalism and are admired by everyone I know in our profession. As a native Angeleno, I also can't thank you enough for all you've given our city. You've made a huge and lasting impact on our community.
I have a little trouble getting through the rest of this. I simply didn't anticipate that, and I'm just so touched by what you've done and what all those people have said. Let me just say that I've been in Los Angeles twice as long as you have. You know twice as much about it as I do.
So. Oh, come on. I don't think that's true, but I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this, but it had to be done. Oh, and I should also note, Warren, that this doesn't mean you're done. You're not retired, and you've got plenty of other irons in the fire.
I don't intend to be done. I have no intention of being done. I will find a way. There has to be a way. The columns are now under the title of Golden State. The book is Independence Day. Steve Lopez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before we close this last episode of the To The Point podcast, I really want to thank the people who made those very generous comments that Steve passed along. Mayor Karen Bass, Professor Fernando Guerra, former supervisors Kuhl and Yaroslavsky, and Larry Mantle. Thank you all so very, very much. What you said means a lot to me, and those words will matter to others as well. There is no way I could name all the people who've been part of my life at KCRW for the past 32 years. The radio broadcast of Which Way LA and To The Point reached a lot of people, both here and around the country. Every program, every podcast has been a team effort. My name's the one on all the awards, but I haven't done it alone. Producers and editors and engineers deserve equal shares of the credit. You know who you are. My thanks to you all. And thanks to you and the listening audience. I'll be looking for new ways to ask you to join me again. The producer of this final To The Point podcast is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is John Meek. Thanks for listening.